Good morning. The 13th International Coral Reef Symposium is underway in Honolulu. Its theme is Bridging Science to Policy, and we'll talk with Nature Conservancy researcher Elizabeth McLeod about engaging faith communities and what some longtime Hawaii nonprofits have learned after decades of service and their future outlook are part of our periodic look at who's caring for our communities. Ron Brandvold of Easter Seals has some thoughts later this hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. An author who was raised on Molokai by Indian immigrant parents crafts a young adult novel about clashing cultures. And Grand Opera comes to Niu Valley Middle School as part of Hawaii Opera Theater's Opera Residency Program.
That's the conversation for Monday, June 20th. Coming up next, the news. Good morning and welcome to the conversation on this solstice day, the longest day of the year for us.
So it is.
Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Really significant gathering in town this week.
Huh? You bet. And we're going to have a couple of conversations that focus on all of that.
Good.
Starting with this one. Now, this week, researchers from around the world are meeting at the 13th International Coral Reef Symposium. One of its goals is to improve trust and communications among scientists, policymakers, managers, and stakeholders. Elizabeth McLeod is a climate adaptation scientist with the Nature Conservancy, and she works to engage faith communities in that conversation. And she's in our studio this morning for another conversation. Hello there.
Hi there, Beth Ann. How are you?
Nice to see you. Thanks. You know, we don't normally think about engaging, you know, faith conversations in conservation conversations. How did those two worlds converge for you as a scientist?
Well, about 15 years ago, I did my undergraduate in religion, focusing on Asian religion and philosophy. And then I started my work with the Nature Conservancy. And over the years working in conservation, I was always surprised at how infrequently we engaged faith groups. And I always saw that as a real opportunity. So I was really excited a couple of years ago to start a project. It was actually a science project to explore how we can broaden our engagement with religious groups around the world.
And how was that received by the Nature Conservancy and other groups?
It's funny you should ask that. I often get two reactions. The first reaction is, well, aren't we doing this anyway? And I think many folks are surprised that we're actually only engaging faith groups in less than 15% of the sites that we work in globally. But the other side is I often get a lot of pushback. I think there's a fear, there's a feeling that we need to assess the risk. I think there's a natural bias in some people working with religious groups due to a potential perceived conflict between religion and science.
Is there one?
Depends on who you ask, and it depends on what part of the world you live in. I think in the United States, for many people, there is. I think I work in Asia Pacific with communities on the ground, and often there's absolutely no conflict at all. I think they're quite naturally merged.
How do they merge in those areas in which you work?
I think actually for a lot of traditional communities, their faith is embedded in their conservation work. It's the there's a spiritual connection to land and water. I think you find that in Hawaii as well. And so I think conservation stewardship is directly tied to those spiritual beliefs and values.
We saw that in Native American culture, too, but not something that transcends the greater American culture. Was there a total disconnect there that's not really come back in the same ways that you see it happening in Asia?
I think, again, it depends on what group you're in. I think what has impressed me with this work is, as I talk to folks who are from the U.S., who are conservation scientists, many of them are in it because of their faith. So I think if you're talking to them, they don't have that disconnect. So I think it's more, it's in the scientific community, there's that, there's a mistrust, and I think there's a lot of bias there that we need to work on.
Is that why some of those scientists who are very faith-based don't speak out in those ways?
Yeah, and actually, as I've spoken with folks, as I've been working on this over the last several years, people often tell me they're afraid to talk about their faith with their colleagues. And so I feel like, you know, initially when I started the work, it was really looking externally at how we develop partnerships with faith groups that are going to help us all move our conservation work forward. But now I've started to realize that a lot of this work is really internally in the Nature Conservancy and figuring out how we can help be more inclusive and accepting of people, allowing people to bring their full selves to work and be more honest about what motivates them and what inspires them to do their work.
What do you see as being the opportunities to do that, and also what are some of the barriers?
The opportunities, I think, are huge. I think we're in a wonderful time right now. I think we have a lot of global challenges, but we have the Pope's encyclical that's just come out, which I think was so inspiring, and it really connected our moral responsibility, our faith, and you know, the need to take action on climate change. And so I think the time is really ripe for us to push that work forward. The challenges, you know, funding is obviously a challenge, getting the funding to support this work. I think also it's really pushing people's boundaries and helping people to be comfortable that faith communities can be some of our most natural allies.
How would you like to see that develop in the United States, particularly in Hawaii?
Well, I think in Hawaii, I think it's actually a bit easier in Hawaii. I think with, as I said, the Native Hawaiian culture, I think there's that spiritual connection to the land and the water. So I think that's already embedded in our conservation work with communities on the ground. I think on the mainland, I think it's a bit more challenging, but I think we have a lot of opportunities to look at how we can engage some of the larger faith-based groups and work together in conservation. I think one of the things that's underappreciated in the scientific community is how active many faith communities already are and have been for many years on conservation activities. So it's really a matter of where we can identify overlapping priorities and how we can work together.
So what are some of those organizations and what are some of those overlapping priorities?
What are some of the organizations?
Who are already doing that? You said they're already faith-based organizations that we just don't talk about or don't know about.
Sure, absolutely. So a lot of there's a lot of interfaith groups actually right now. One is Green Faith that's based on the East Coast, and they actually bring faith communities together. There's Interfaith Power and Light. They do a lot of energy work and tackling climate change. So there's a lot totally outside of the conservation community that's happening on the ground. And so right now we're just exploring how we can help bring our science to bear to those efforts and then how we can help learn from them and build our constituency of conservation science and action on the ground.
As you are engaged in all of that work to make that more known to the rest of us, what do you see has to happen on the other side of that to have the willingness to talk about that conversation or to have that conversation?
I think for me, the first challenge is really bringing everybody in the same room together. I mean, I think it gets back to open dialogue. One of the things that's impressed me, we've had a number of workshops over the last several years bringing together conservation scientists with faith leaders. And after all of those meetings, there is such a recognition of the value of bringing those groups together and talking about and really getting into some of the challenges and the biases and sharing how each group adds value to the other. You know, and I think there's this also a perception that conservation communities will use faith groups as a mouthpiece to spread their mission. And I think that, you know, it really has to go both ways. We have to look at what we bring to the table to help their initiatives and efforts and then how they can help share their efforts and their strengths to support our conservation.
If you had to encapsulate what that nexus looks like, what is it?
It's a difficult question. I think it is. I think it's really about meeting and trying to find a common ground, identifying for particular partnerships where those overlapping priorities are. I think in some cases it's going to be education. I think it's, you know, food security or water security, but finding those priority issues and overlaps and then really helping to figure out how we can most strategically take them forward.
And specifically regarding coral reefs, what's the message that you think needs to be carried?
I think
both ways.
Yeah, I think we're in the midst of one of the worst coral bleaching events globally due to the El Nino combined with climate change. There is a need for hope right now. You know, we're having a meeting of over 2,000 conservation scientists. I just dove on the North Shore. Corals are bleached. People need a reason to be empowered and hopeful. And so I feel like working with faith communities really will help us to bring that inspiration and that hope and help us to tackle climate change.
Dr. Lizzie McLeod, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much
for
having
me. Good to
talk to you. Thank you.
Lizzie McLeod is the Nature Conservancy's marine climate scientist for the Asia Pacific region. She's also the lead science, or the science lead for the Reef Resilience Network, which provides latest scientific guidance and resources to help coral reef managers globally to address the impacts of climate change and local threats. She's in town for the 13th International Coral Reef Symposium. We'll be talking more about that as the week progresses.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13, and coming up, a novelist brings a unique cross-cultural perspective to the young adult genre. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, a hit song with a story behind it. The song we're remembering was written on the occasion of a visit to the Friendly Isle from the 1930s movie star. He was Warner Baxter, best remembered as the Cisco Kid. He came to Molokai to visit Paul Fagan, the owner of Puuhoku Ranch, who asked songwriter R. Alex Anderson to write a tune for his guest of honor. Baxter was especially popular on Molokai, and as the Molokai Dispatch reported, it was because he, quote, was a film star that rides wild horses. Baxter was named an honorary mayor at the luau held in his honor, where he proceeded to get very, very drunk. His inebriated state became the subject of Anderson's song, immortalized with lyrics like, "He wore a lei and he wore a smile. He drank a gallon of oak to make life worthwhile." Baxter and his movie studio, though, were not amused. But the song became an often recorded Hapa'haole classic. This morning, we're looking for the name of the song, and we bet you know. We'll be back with it in half an hour. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you've got the answer. The first one to get it right gets the HPR t-shirt.
Good morning, I'm Jonathan Korth from HCMS, Honolulu Chamber Music Series. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
When your cultural background and your day-to-day world are in conflict, the tension can pull you apart. It's a story Sonia Patel knows well as a therapist and as the author of a young adult novel called Ronnie Patel in Full Effect. Sonia was raised on Molokai by a family that came here from India, and her novel takes us into the world of a 16-year-old dealing with cultural clashes that threaten to destroy her. It's a literature born of rap and slam poetry, and Sonia's with us in our studio. Good morning, Sonia.
Good morning.
You kind of address the turmoil of adolescent life head on in this book, don't you?
Yes.
Why is that important?
I think it's important for people to get a sense of how teenagers think and feel and act and how they make choices. In this novel, I really want to show how when a teenager is brought up with a difficult background, mm-hmm. how that can influence the way they see the world, the way they make decisions, the way they think and feel, and how they actually form relationships. All of that is based on their experience.
Is your protagonist's background similar to your own as a product of an immigrant family?
Yes. I draw a lot of parallels from my own upbringing.
And you're the product of an arranged marriage, the child and grandchild of arranged marriages, right?
Correct. Both of my grandparents were traditionally arranged. They didn't know each other before, and the same with my parents.
Mm-hmm. Were you under some pressure to follow that path?
Oh, yes. They tried to do that. They actually had me meet boys. I had to fly to the mainland to meet boys, but I said no.
So you met boys in the immigrant community, the
yes.
American immigrant community.
Actually, it was strange because, not strange, but I guess how it worked out is the boys they happened to set me up with were from India, but I was born and raised here. So
yeah.
there was a cultural conflict there too.
Already, so.
Mm-hmm. They were wanting, I remember some of those boys were wanting me to be a stay home, cook and clean kind of person.
And would you talk it over with them when you met, say, what kind of wife are you looking for, that kind of thing?
I wouldn't talk very much, but they would definitely let me know because I wasn't very
they would tip
hot
their
on
hand.
The idea. Yeah.
yeah. Well, it seems amazing in a lot of ways that that happens in the modern world, but it's very much a part of the modern world.
Yes, and it's funny because my parents thought it was their duty.
That's what
to do so.
Well, that's what culture is, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a sense of things that really are not optional in how you live your life.
Absolutely.
So how do you go about breaking out of that? I mean, for your character, for yourself, for anyone?
Yeah, I mean, for myself, it was a very difficult process to extricate myself. I mean, there was a lot of dysfunction in my family, and that was sort of how it started. I said no to these things. I met my own husband. It's a love marriage, and that broke a lot of traditions. My father didn't speak to me for a long time.
Really?
It was very complicated.
And yet you found a happy marriage.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, with a wonderful man. So, and in the book, Ronnie, she goes through, she has dysfunction in her family. Her parents arranged marriage as a sham. You know, there's a lot of dysfunction hidden that kind of slowly comes out in the book. You discover that her father turns to her for all her needs and even the intimate ones. And so when she catches her father two-timing with a woman who's barely older than her, she feels like a widow because they were so strangely close, so
mm-hmm.
inappropriately close. So like many widows in India are forced to do, she shaves her head. And that's sort of how the story gets going.
Wow.
That's her form of like rebellion, her way of coping, her way of saying, wait, what is going on?
And yet she lives in modern-day America.
Yes. Yes.
And not only in modern day America, but in the hip hop
yes.
community, which is about as modern as modern day
yep.
America gets, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she uses that as a, like, that's the only form of personal identity she actually has.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was a springboard for which she finds her way through all of this chaos in her family.
And yet, in that's a world where you reinvent yourself all the time. You give yourself a new name. You change your look, everything, right?
Yes.
She does that?
She does that. And she thinks she has to do that in order to be, to be herself. But by the end of the book, she kind of discovers that she doesn't need to be anyone else. She's good, just as she is.
Well,
and so the two worlds kind of mix.
Being a teenager, what she wants is to be accepted by somebody, right?
Yes. Yes. And it was all about her dad before, but then she discovers that she's good by herself. She can do this, and she ends up replacing her dad with someone else in the story, which is the twist.
Well, you know, Sonia, I mean, as you say, you grew up with some dysfunction of this type in your own life,
mm-hmm.
and yet you deal with it every day as a psychotherapist. I would have thought you would have wanted to walk away from that.
Yes, it's strange. Physician, heal thyself, I guess.
Yeah.
I never had a psychiatrist. I wish I did. But, you know, I think it kind of gives me a bit of empathy that's different than what you can read about in books. And I'm hoping it helps me connect with people
yeah.
that have gone through this in a deeper way. Yeah.
Has it been your experience that severe trauma is, you know, you can bounce back a long way?
Yes. I mean, it takes time. I like to tell my patients that the number of years they suffered through trauma, it may take that many years to fully heal. Not that it's necessarily that painful all those years, but it does take time because you have to heal the way you think, the way you feel, the way you create relationships. That all takes time.
Trauma can really make some fundamental changes in how everything is perceived.
Absolutely.
Thereafter, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what people don't realize is that chronic sexual violence, chronic sexual trauma can affect the way a brain develops. It actually can damage the brain. And so therefore, people see the symptoms of the trauma, which is like depression, self-destructive behavior, PTSD, but actually it's at a biologic level. And so to change that's why it takes so long, because you have to create new brain pathways to kind of experience healing.
And as always, Sonia, the trick is to understand it, right?
Yes.
Thanks very much for talking with us this
morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Sonia Patel is the author of Rani Patel in Full Effect, a young adult novel to be published in the fall by Cinco Puntos Press. And you can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
European countries are divided over the herbicide glyphosate, the main ingredient of Monsanto's Roundup.
You have the most well-respected agency on cancer research saying glyphosate is a probable carcinogen, and then regulatory agencies coming to the opposite conclusion.
I'm Steve Kerwood, and what that could mean for Monsanto and America next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
This afternoon at 4, following Fresh Air.
According to Nielsen Research, it's likely that on the street where you live, 1 in 8 of your neighbors listens to Hawaii Public Radio each week. Some of them have gone beyond just listening and with their financial support have made our services available for the rest of the community. Please join us in thanking these good neighbors, Christine Gaspar, Nasa Lee, and Marion Burned. You too can do the neighborly thing and become an HPR member donor by calling us at 955-8821. If you'd like to find out more, you can also call that number, or you can visit hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, presenting vocalist Lisa Fisher and her band Grand Baton in 2 shows nightly, June 23rd through 26th. Tickets at bluenotehawaii.com.
Are Hawaii inmates housed on the mainland and then released more likely to reoffend than their Hawaii counterparts? It's a question that, according to Civil Beat, doesn't really have an answer. Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So there's really been no serious data gathered about whether these two groups are more likely, just as likely, not all likely to be in the same
not
boat?
Not completely no data at all. There was a 2011 study that the Attorney General's office conducted, and what they found was that folks in the mainland, prisoners from Hawaii held in Arizona, weren't necessarily more likely to recommit a crime and end up back in prison. But the problem with that study, as it admitted, was that a whole bunch more data was needed to conclusively determine that. We do track recidivism rates here locally. There is a group that's called the Interagency Council on Intermediate Sanctions, a very lengthy name for a body that's job is to try and bring that recidivism rate down. Its goal is to bring it down 30%. And it does show some progress locally in terms of parolees and probationers, but it does not track specifically those 1,400 or so prisoners that we have in Arizona.
So according to that latest study, what is the rate of recidivism?
Well, there has been some progress in bringing down, in particular, the number of parolees that have dropped down in terms of going back into prison. There are various numbers. I don't want to confuse our listeners with too many of them. But on the good side, parolee recidivism rate is down. A problem more so with probationers. They have reduced their recidivism rates much less so. So there is a concern about focusing on that. Now, should we be studying the mainland? Well, that's what folks like Kat Brady think, because as you know, we have reported on this program that prisoners that are not in close touch, close contact with their family and their friends, they are much more likely to commit a crime once they get out of prison. So that's the reason why people are saying, gee, maybe we should be tracking these numbers on the mainland, given that we spend millions of dollars to house our prisoners there.
Kat Brady being the coordinator of the Community right. Alliance on Prisons and having looked at this for a very long time. But of those prisoners who go to the mainland, isn't there some cherry picking going on with that too to make sure that they're well suited to being there so that maybe that might skew the numbers a little bit differently?
That's true. They generally, it's called, skimming the cream off the top there, trying to get the less violent, the more manageable prisoners to go to the mainland so that it will be less problems. So, yes, that does skewer the results. But the Department of Public Safety, which oversees our prisons, isn't really interested in studying the mainland numbers. They have directed all inquiries to this council that we told you about. The council, by the way, is housed in our judiciary. They said they've received no formal request to do that, to look at the mainland numbers to see whether recidivism rates are up or down. They are open to suggestions, but it has to come from us. So people like Kat Brady are saying, well, this is crazy. We really should be about rehabilitating people, returning them to the community, not just throw them in the prison and then throw away the key. Kat Brady argues that the Public Safety Department is all about incarcerations, not really trying to help people return to society.
Well, perhaps the judiciary will take a look at this article as being one of those requests.
That's our job here at Civil Beat, to spurn people into action.
All right. Well, we're going to talk to you tomorrow and take some more action. We talk again with tomorrow's Reality Check. Thanks so much for today.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us every day with a Reality Check.
Good morning, I'm Chris Vandercook, and at 8:30, you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. You can talk back to us about what you hear on the show on our talkback line, which is 808-792-8217, or find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up later, bringing grand opera to the classroom. Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, you're going to look at kidney failure.
Yes, we are. We're going to talk about what causes it, and more importantly, what can everybody do to keep their kidneys healthy as much as possible?
If it's not, what are the treatment options?
Well, you know, the first thing that happens when the kidneys don't do well is that we have to adjust all the medications to make sure they don't linger in the body too long. We give people certain medications in addition to that, continue to monitor kidneys, but sort of further down the line, the worst case scenario is, do they need to start initiating dialysis? And that's sort of when we have machines take over the job of the kidneys. But at the same time, there's also another opportunity for people to consider kidney transplant. So we're going to talk today about what that road and what that progress looks like, and who qualifies for one versus the other, and what can we all do to help support transplants here in Hawaii.
Has transplantation come quite a long way?
It absolutely has. You know, we used to be very, very careful about trying to make sure somebody doesn't reject their kidney. They would be on extremely strong medications that had pretty disastrous side effects themselves. So now we've gotten much better at it, and we understand the body's handling of kidney transplants. And we also know that we can do, even in some cases, live donor transplants. So there's a lot to learn, and we'll talk about it today.
Sounds good, Kathy. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
If you also listen to HPR 1, you've no doubt heard part of Bob Wehrman's series, The Benevolent Mind. It explores philanthropy and was created in partnership with the Hawaii Community Foundation, celebrating its centenary this year. In our periodic look at trends and changes in the nonprofit world, today we get the view from a group in operation in Hawaii for 70 years. Easter Seal CEO Ron Branville joins us now. Thanks so much for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
70 years, given the the length of time that Hawaii as a state that before their territory has been around, it seems like it's a decent lens to be able to look at some of the trends and some of the movements within the nonprofit world. But certainly we all got a big lesson over the last 10 years in particular. Your organization being so social services grounded has perhaps a different take on that than other groups that just followed the nonprofit umbrella. What do you think some of the big issues that we face now really are in social services?
I would say it's priorities, that of the government, of the people, of the philanthropers who donate to causes of their interest. For us, it is to remain viable to those individuals and those groups, and so that we are their choice when it comes to the donations that they're inclined to make.
Most organizations would love to fall into that category too, being the organization of choice. But with social services and the way in which they've been funded, in some cases that's become sort of an entitlement mentality. Is that also a danger that you see that needs to be dealt with?
It is. Traditionally, throughout history, the philanthropy and for social services in particular was more through churches and people with wealth and average individuals who would support those things that are close to their heart. 50 or so years ago, more government programs and spending became prevalent, and nonprofit organizations, many of them including Easter Seals, moved in the direction of taking advantage of those funding streams and providing services built up around them. And it was a positive because it allowed us to serve more people and to tailor those services to the true needs of the community. There's always more need than there are resources, so it's a constant challenge to do the right thing.
As you look at Hawaii, do you see that those services are necessarily in sync with the money as much as in sync with the community?
To a degree, you'd have to say yes, because there is a vetting process, and when it's distributed in the manner that it is, it's by the basis of perceived need for those distributing. For our purposes, we build programs around available resources. What happens then over time, as you say, the concept of entitlement, if that's accurate, I'm inclined to think it is, that you start out providing for a need, but then you become somewhat immune to that because that need is being met for a period of time and other needs become predominant in our community now. Homelessness is huge, and a lot of the resources are being directed toward that. Even in today's paper, there's an article about the city and county and the funding that is being offered, and it's 0.5% of the total budget for the city that goes to nonprofits. There didn't used to be a cap per se on how much that could be. Now it's $125,000. It's spread out over a lot of different organizations. We are competing for that money.
It sounds in many ways that this has been a journey of chasing money, and that in chasing the money, that some of maybe the needs that you thought you might be addressing aren't necessarily encapsulated by what that money is being available to do. What happens with that lack of funding for the needs that you see as being really appropriate when the money clearly isn't there to do that, particularly as you're talking about a social services base? What happens then for you?
Well, it becomes incumbent upon us to sustain that service if we're able. And we do fundraising and we do donor cultivation and try to identify people who share our interest and our desire to help in the community and in the areas that we serve. We're a birth throughout life organization. We focus on the 0 to 3, which is early intervention, which is essential. The more you can do, the better, the more impact it has throughout a person's life. But we also do adult programs, and the transition now is toward helping individuals within their community. Not so much in the past, where it was a facilities-driven organization.
You mean like to park them someplace?
Correct. And we have never done day care per se. We have a day health program for adults, and we try to expand their independence, teach them daily living skills, and transition them into the community. That is the direction of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which provides oversight for our services and many others. The direction now is for employment. If you can help an individual to become employed, then they engage on levels in the community that are helpful for them, that lead to their greater independence. And then, two, they don't require the services in your facilities or in their homes.
Does that also mean that you're looking at collaboration with other organizations and agencies to be able to make that happen in a different way than it might perhaps happen if you were having to go it alone?
We are certainly open to that, and we do that. And what it means, though, from the employment standpoint, is expanding a societal type perspective where in the past you perceive people for their limitations or their disabilities. Through a discovery process with our participants, we try to identify that they are interested in, that they want to do, would like to do, and then match those skills to a need at through an employer, and help that employer and by extension society realize that these people can contribute and they are employable. And when you see them in their jobs, then it can be a source of pride for everyone.
Who would you like to partner with if you had your magic wand and you could make a partnership happen?
I think it would be, again, expanding it beyond an entity or a group of entities. I think it would be societal in nature, getting people's minds to shift to see that everyone has value and everyone has potential and can contribute. Each person may be very unique in their way, and it takes work in some cases more than others. But so it's a broader thing than just one or a few.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you. I hope
your vision comes true.
Appreciate it.
Ron Branfeld is president and CEO of Easter Seals Hawaii, this year celebrating its 70th year.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about a Hapa'haole classic written by R. Alex Anderson, written to commemorate the visit of movie star Warner Baxter to Molokai. As the story goes, Baxter got very drunk at a luau held in his honor, a luau where he was named honorary mayor of the island, in keeping with the long-standing Molokai tradition. Anderson wrote the tune at the request of Baxter's host, Pu'uhoku Ranch owner Paul Fagan. Baxter never used it in any of his movies, believing it reflected badly on his Hollywood lifestyle, but it became a hit song for Anderson, Hilo Hattie, and the Andrews sisters, among others. Perhaps Baxter, beloved in the movies as the Cisco Kid, was uncomfortable with lyrics like, "He was just a lazy Malahini haole boy, but all the girls were crazy to share his fish and poi. He was the cockeyed mayor of Kona Kakai." That's the song title we were looking for.
And guess what? We heard from David Kangas, who called us from Kona Kakai, knew the answer, and will be receiving the T-shirt. And if you want to hear some good tunes to that, go to YouTube. I heard the Andrews Sisters version this morning.
It's a great song.
Yeah, it was really fun. Thanks very much for calling us. And if you'd like to participate in the Backyard Quiz by sending a question, you can do that by sending it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Doctors and hospitals share information to save lives. Easy, right?
We are struggling, and beating our heads against the wall every day.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Medical data and the business models built on it. We'll have the rest of the day's business news and the numbers from Wall Street as well. Next time, Marketplace.
This evening at 6, right after The Body Show. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the vast universe around our very small planet, as well as what to look for in our dark island skies. As usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips for our report. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's happening this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in the evening sky. All three planets are very bright, easy to spot, although you'll have to be fairly quick to spot Jupiter as it will be setting early at around about 11 p.m. The moon will start the week almost full, but will gradually wane, becoming less bright towards the end of the week, making for better conditions for stargazing.
And I understand that you have some really interesting news this week that is related to a discovery right here in the Aloha State, and it has to do with an asteroid that has a very unusual relationship to Earth.
It is indeed. This week, a remarkable discovery from the Pan-STARRS Observatory atop Haleakala on Maui. Astronomers using the highly sensitive instruments that are part of this asteroid-hunting telescope have discovered a small asteroid that is following the Earth in its orbit around the Sun. In fact, the orbit of this asteroid is so similar to our own, we are now calling it a quasi-satellite. This is a name we give to an object that could almost be a natural moon of the Earth. The moon itself that we see in our night skies is a natural satellite. This newly discovered asteroid is not quite close enough to be classed as that, but it is very close indeed.
And I know Pan-STARRS track some dangerous stuff at times. How close does this thing get to Earth, and is it going to be a problem?
Luckily for us, this will not pose any danger due to its very stable orbit. The asteroid itself only gets as close as around 9 million miles from the Earth. That's very far away. And to put it in perspective, our own moon is much, much closer, at about 240,000 miles. Let's also not forget that this asteroid is quite small, somewhere around 200 feet in diameter.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. And that is still, though, big enough to have that thing plow into the Earth. We're done, right?
It would cause major problems, but it's probably not enough to wipe out life on Earth.
And one final question. Would that thing at 200 feet in diameter burn up on entry, or would it make it through our atmosphere?
It would totally make it through.
All right. Well, let's hope it has a very stable orbit, as you are describing, and an ominous and intriguing report this week. Christopher Phillips, thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from HTA, a public charter school serving students grades K through 12 on each island, providing each student with the opportunity for a personalized learning plan combining face-to-face and virtual instruction. Learn more at myhta.org.
It's a challenge faced by opera companies around the world, reaching out to young audiences. The task is made easier by programs like the collaboration between Neo Valley Middle School and Hawaii Opera Theater, a summer opera residency that gives students an opportunity to stage a production of Aida, no less. Eric Haynes leads the Hawaii Opera Theater's education department. He's seen what happens when young people get a taste of grand opera, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Eric.
Hi, good morning.
What does happen when young people get a taste of grand opera?
Boy, for a lot of them, it changes their lives. It changes the way their parents look at them. It changes the way their teachers look at them.
In what ways? I mean, what changes about them?
We just finished a residency out in Aiea Elementary, and we were talking to the principal after the project was finished, and she said, these kids are walking taller with more confidence. The teachers see, a lot of these kids aren't necessarily the highest, getting the highest grades in their academics, and all of a sudden they go out and they're getting an A on the stage, and they're just doing things no one ever thought they could do, and they see the kids in a whole different light.
It's a chance for them to be kind of judged and judge themselves by criteria other than the schools, right?
Absolutely. And we've had a couple kids where they've gone through this program and they go, wow, I never knew I could do this.
Yeah.
And then we come upon them later in life in our such in our high school program or in our adult program.
Which is kind of it argues that you shouldn't decide in advance what's good for kids and what ain't, right?
Absolutely.
Because, you know, as you well know, the traditional perception of opera is that it's something sort of arcane and for a
a kind of an isolated audience, usually an older audience, right?
Oh, right. It's giant people that yell really loud that carry spears, right? But the kids come to it very naturally. They don't second guess it. They call it the drama program, and the first thing we tell the kids out there, it's not drama, it's opera. Sorry about that. that doesn't faze them at all. And you know, you go by that school, and you're going to hear famous choruses from Aida out in the parking lot. The kids are just going for it.
Well, you know, it, in a way, it makes a lot of sense because kids love things that are extravagant, over the top, dramatic, right?
Absolutely.
Intense. Absolutely. All those things would describe grand opera, wouldn't you say?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, kids are dramatic, just naturally.
Sure.
You give them this opportunity to rein it in or expand it depending on the kid, and then you know, then they also not only get to be on stage, but they also have to figure out, you know, what does Aida look like? Where did this stuff take place? What did Egypt look like? Then figure out how are we going to build a set? How are we going to get costumes together? What kind of props would these people have? And so they have to also do a lot of research.
The demands of going on stage, you know, nobody, I mean, maybe there are a few people somewhere who find it easy to get on stage and just give it all. But for the most of us, it's a struggle. It's a huge hurdle to overcome, right?
It's true. It is a hurdle. And so part of the process for us is building their courage.
Yeah.
And so the first thing that we do first day is, okay, you have to stand up and give your name. Mm-hmm. And then each day, that task gets a little bit harder.
Uh-huh.
And so by the end, you know, the kids can stand up there and sing a solo in front of the other kids. They can do an improv exercise with another kid in front of an audience, and they've just gained leaps and bounds in their confidence.
Every time you do something that you're terrified to do and succeed at it, it's kind of a quantum leap forward, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And you know, you see those kids that were very tentative at first getting up there, and now they just march right up there, and it's not an issue anymore for them.
We've all met people who are huge extroverts on stage, who off stage are, you know, very self-effacing, shy, have trouble looking you in the eye, right? There are people who completely transform getting on stage. Have you seen that among young people?
Oh, yeah. I've seen it amongst young people and also with a lot of adults as well.
In sure.
The productions we do now at Blaisdell.
Is it good for you? If you are by nature reticent, is taking a crack at the performing arts, can it help you out?
Oh, yeah. I think so. Because you have to do job interviews. You have to do presentations, whether it's in the classroom or in the real world, and we teach the kids, you know, there's two yous. There's the you when you're sitting in your room or when you're by yourself, and then there's the presentational you.
Yeah.
And you have to decide, you know, which one do you need to turn on at which time in order to survive in life, and that's okay, and to figure out the skills on how to deal with that.
And even if the presentational you doesn't get a standing ovation, it doesn't kill you, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that and also that it is such an important skill to have in life.
Yeah, I mean, people are more afraid of public speaking than they are of being run over by a bus. It's amazing.
Yeah, and we try to bring beyond that. Imagine trying to sing in front of people, which is a huge fear for most people.
No kidding.
And you know, we've had kids where they've started the process just speaking their name, and just that was the fear of doing that in front of people was enough to make them cry. And by the end, they've built enough confidence where they can actually go up and sing in front of people by themselves.
That's got to be a rewarding thing to see.
It really is.
Well, the other thing that you've got is this isn't just getting up in front of people and singing. This is everything to do with mounting a production.
Absolutely.
That you're doing, right? And with all the challenges, you were saying you've had some challenges in the space that's available. And
yeah, there's a big construction project going on, which nobody knew about, so we're trying to mount a production in the middle of a very major refurb of their cafeteria.
Can you kind of see that binding the kids?
You know, the kids, I think, seem less phased by it than we do.
Uh-huh.
I guess we're thinking about all the nuts and bolts, and they're just going, okay, we got to learn a few melodies, and we got to get up there on stage and get our costumes together, and they seem to ignore the whole thing.
Which makes it sound as if there's a bit of two-way education going here.
Yeah, I think that is true.
Because I think a lot of adults in the arts are really trying to get to a lot of the attitudes that kids find natural.
Yeah, and that is one of the, I think the challenging things about it is convincing the adults that this is a very viable and very natural thing for the kids.
Yeah,
they take to it like to ducks like water, and the adults are going, whoa, that's that big scary opera stuff, and the kids are like, yeah, whatever, we're just singing, having a good time, and we're learning about Egypt.
If you don't tell them it's big and scary, it's not necessarily going to be, is it?
Exactly.
Well, that really sounds like a great project. Thanks so much for coming in, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Haynes is the Hawaii Opera Theater's Director of Education, and his students will offer a free public performance of Giuseppe Verdi's Aida Tuesday, June 28th at 6 p.m. in the Niu Valley Middle School cafeteria.
On the next Humankind.
Coming into camp, they may have hated every single person on the other side, just as a matter of course, but the attitude changes.
A remarkable summer camp in Maine brings together teenagers from opposing sides of world conflicts. I'm David Freudberg. Join us for Humankind.
This evening at 6:30, right after Marketplace.
The Coral Reef Symposium underway this week is really, there's an opportunity here, isn't there?
Well, and that's why over 2,000 researchers and scientists and concerned others are here, and we'll be having more conversations as the week unfolds to find out more about some of the different angles that are looking at reef preservation.
One of the things that in any issue like this is communication among stakeholders, experts, sharing information, right? And Hawaii is the place to do it because we've been gathering so much information about things like coral bleaching, really serious concerns. Yeah,
and to hear that Elizabeth McLeod is saying that we should be looking into faith communities too as a way of being able to get that understanding out, and also to acknowledge that there have been these conversations within faith-based communities for quite a while, and that those things, science and faith, don't have to be mutually exclusive, because in many cases they're already not.
Well, there's certainly a lot of unharnessed energy to be harnessed in that.
And that's what she's counting on. But interesting to have heard her say earlier today that she got those very different reactions, like, aren't we doing this already? And, maybe we shouldn't go there. So we'll see how that plays out and what else happens this week at the Coral Symposium.
Good story.
A very good story. More to come. And we will be back with you tomorrow morning with some more issues and fun stuff, too, including you're going to talk about polo
including
tomorrow.
A celebration of Hawaii's polo tradition.
All right. Well, look forward to that. In the meantime, we would like to hear from you if you'd like to be so inclined to give us a call at our talkback line. It's 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past show, you can find them on the conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under talk shows for the conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vanderbilt.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning back here for more of The Conversation.